This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, we'll talk to education reporter Jeannie Lindsay about legislation that would remove standardized test performance as a factor in teacher evaluations. She'll help us understand who wants it and why. And later, Bloomington writer Craig Fairman talks with us about his new book, Author in Chief, The Untold Stories of the Presidents and the Books They Wrote. You may be surprised at some of the Indiana connections he found. But first, every Friday, he's been catching us up on the legislative session. Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, it's my penultimate appearance this session.
That's right.
One more to go.
One more week. Are you eager to have it behind you?
No, I love when the lawmakers are in session because they're all in one place where I can keep track of them.
So
I love the session.
Before we get to the session, though, we've got some news about the coronavirus.
Yeah, Indiana has its first positive case of coronavirus, which, as health officials said today, was always a matter of when, not if, given the nature of the virus. So they announced that earlier today, Friday, that a Marion County resident who had been in Boston at a conference flew back to Indiana on Wednesday, believed he had the symptoms, called ahead yesterday to the health department and then to the hospital, said, I'm worried I have this. They set up a system at the hospital at Community North in Marion County where they were able to take him in a side entrance, keep him separated from everybody else, kind of isolate him. The test did come back positive. He is now in self-isolation at home. They believe this is an isolated case, though, of course, they're monitoring other people as well around the state and have been for a while. But this is the first positive case here in Indiana. And what health officials are emphasizing is a few things. One, a lot of this is on individual people to practice their best hygiene practices, if you will. Wash your hands for 20 to 30 seconds at least using soap, or if you don't have soap, an antibacterial or a hand sanitizer with at least 60% alcohol. Cough into your arm, sneeze into a tissue, throw that tissue away, then wash your hands. Don't shake hands with people. Do the elbow bump as Governor Holcomb and Dr. Chris Box did this morning. And also, if you are worried you have these symptoms, which are fever, coughing, or shortness of breath, call ahead to your doctor or to the healthcare facility because they want to try and manage this as best as possible.
It sounds like this person took all of those precautions.
Yeah, kudos to whoever this person is. Obviously, they could only tell us so many things about them, but kudos to this person who did everything right, it appears.
Okay. Any more on the coronavirus?
Just be cautious. Be careful. The person who is that we know has it here in Indiana is not in the sort of at-risk pool, which is generally older folks or those who are immunocompromised, who are already sick kind of thing. Again, it was always a matter of when and not if. So there will probably almost certainly be more in Indiana. Don't panic. Just do the things that health officials are saying to do.
And we hope things turn out well for that person. All right. What do we know now about Curtis Hill? What's the update this week?
Yeah, kind of surprising because legislative leaders had indicated they didn't want to go down this path this session. But we got a little more clarity on what will happen to Curtis Hill if the Supreme Court decides to suspend his license. State law was very unclear about what would happen in that case. All it says is you have a law license and you're a citizen, and that's all it takes to be attorney general. What was unclear was, well, if it's just suspended for a certain length of time, what does that mean about his ability to run again, about his ability to remain in the job? And now House lawmakers are trying to bring some clarity to that. So they passed an amendment to a bill this week and then passed the bill that would say if an attorney general, if the attorney general is suspended, and not just this one, but any attorney general going forward, has their law license suspended for at least 30 days, and the hearing officer recommended Curtis Hill's license be suspended for 60 days. So if the license is suspended for at least 30 days, they can no longer be attorney general. The governor gets to fill that vacancy. It also says if at any time in the last 5 years an attorney general candidate has had their law license suspended for at least 30 days, they are not eligible to run for the position. So we'll see if the Senate agrees to this and how lawmakers finish that up. But we also know that the governor is in support of that language and that legislation.
All right. Syringe exchange. We are seeing some fast movement on this syringe exchange bill, it seems.
It's all but wrapped up now. The House sent it to the governor this week. This would extend for 1 year Indiana's 9 syringe exchange programs after the Senate kind of put them at greater risk of elimination earlier this session. The governor is very in support of syringe exchange programs, so we expect him to sign that bill. This would extend those programs out to 2022 and give everybody a little more time, particularly next year in a budget session, to figure out how to sort of permanently deal with those on a long-term basis.
And, of course, Representative Ed Clare was an author of that extension, and we will be featuring him on Monday. We will do an entire show on the syringe exchange program and the extension and what it does for Indiana. Okay, what is this about voting machines?
Well, Indiana's voting machines don't have paper backups in every county in Indiana, and election security experts of all stripes say paper backups are really important because if something goes wrong, it's a way to look back and see to make sure that the vote was what we thought it was. Mm. So when, you know, obviously, as we in society have moved more to automation and electronic sort of technology, so have voting systems. And there's a good and a bad with that. It makes counting the vote easier. It makes voting in some cases easier. But if you don't have paper backups, it makes checking those results more difficult. Indiana spent $10 million in last year's budget to start to update the machines that need them. But more than half of the counties in Indiana still don't. And Republican lawmakers this session have refused multiple times, including late last week. They have refused to spend any more money in the short term to help get those machines.
Okay, so the argument is hard copies. Always got to have hard copies.
Got to have hard copies.
All right. Referendum money, public school referendums, and charter schools want a piece.
Yeah, and this has gone back to for a decade. The charter schools have always wanted some of the money that goes to public schools, whether it was property tax dollars or more recently the referendums that we see around the state that public schools put on the ballot. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this week, we saw an amendment on the Senate floor that said that public schools can. They don't have to, but they can split that referendum money with charter schools. Now, in some cases, public schools are the authorizers of those charter schools. They're the ones who set them up. And so there's an argument from some that say, well, there are going to be public school districts that want to do this. It'll also help them make the argument about why you should vote for those referendums on the ballot. But there are folks who worry that this is the first step towards mandating that public schools split those dollars with charter schools. And that's what really scares a lot of people who are public school advocates.
Yes. So this does not force
public schools. It does not force them. Absolutely not. It absolutely does not force anyone to do it. It's just a, as they call it, a may provision right now. But what worries folks is the slippery slope kind of argument. And in some cases, the slippery slope is very real. In others, it's not. So on this one, it sounds like it'll be a wait and see approach.
Okay. So a bill went to the governor on the employment of minors. Can you clear this up?
Yeah, it would make it easier for places to employ young people. It would, for one thing, get rid of student work permits by the summer of 2021. So schools wouldn't know necessarily anymore what their students are doing in the workplace. You know, are these students working or not? Because schools right now have to kind of sign off on that. And that bothers some schools. And so there's some conversation about making sure that the state, that the schools have access to the information about, okay, are my students working? Are they not? Because that can affect test, you know, grades, student performance, that sort of thing. It also says that 16, 18-year-olds now could work 40 hours a week during the school year and 48 hours a week on holidays, which is a bit of an expansion.
Mm. Let's see. Oh, there was some talk of some changes that might be made at the state level that would affect public transportation in certain cities.
This is really about Marion County.
Just about Marion County.
It really is. So several years ago, the legislature created this sort of opportunity for Marion County to really expand mass transit. And we've seen that here in Indianapolis with the Red Line. There are some Republicans who really don't like the way it was rolled out. And they're pointing to a provision in that law from a few years ago that said Indianapolis had to come up with 10% of its funding that it had raised from sort of private sources. And they haven't really done that yet. They're setting up that system to do that, but they haven't really got that funding yet. And so what Senate Republicans tried to do is say, we're going to cut your funding until you get that 10%, until you comply with the law that we never gave any teeth to anyway. But it seems like slightly cooler heads will prevail at the State House, because now it's going back to the House, and sort of House leadership have said, well, maybe we'll do a ramp up. Maybe, you know, we're going to set benchmarks for you that we want you to get that number. We did put that in the law for a reason, but we're not going to have a cutoff abruptly the way that the Senate Republicans tried to do. That it's going to be a glide path towards, we're going to give you time to do that. We're going to set benchmarks for you to achieve it before we would start to cut off any funding.
It seems like public transportation does seem a little partisan. Why is it that some Republicans aren't fans?
Well, Indianapolis is a Democratic city. And they just got more Democratic on the council after the last rounds of elections. And there are Republicans who don't like that. But this is a pattern, not just on public transportation, but of the Indiana General Assembly, which is obviously Republican dominated, interfering in Indianapolis politics and government, which is democratically dominated, over this and a variety of other issues, including landlord-tenant relations this session.
Just had a show about that yesterday.
Exactly. So that's ongoing right now. So there's a lot of politics involved here beyond any sort of public policy questions.
All right. So let's look at the week ahead, the last week of the 2020 legislative session. What are we expecting?
Well, we expect them to wrap up by Wednesday. The incoming Speaker of the House, Todd Houston, who's going to get sworn in on Monday as longtime Speaker Brian Bosma steps down. He said he'd love to be out Tuesday, but he said, quote, I have met the enemy and it is us. So it looks like Wednesday is your best bet, which is a few days ahead of when they have to get out of town, because the Big Ten men's basketball tournament is in town and all the lawmakers are going to get kicked out of their hotel rooms, which is how the General Assembly will wrap up its work this year. So we're looking at Wednesday. There are several dozen bills still unresolved, but lawmakers seem pretty confident that they'll get the important work done, which is at this point focused on healthcare transparency measures, priorities of both caucuses, or both chambers, I should say, and they're just tweaking some details. It sounds like those bills will reach the finish line.
Basketball reigns. We had a basketball
Absolutely.
Show on Tuesday. It seems like we're on top of it,
it's
I guess.
The state of basketball here in Indiana.
And really, really quickly, we only have a couple seconds. Pat Bauer was honored this week.
He was. 50 years, the longest serving state lawmaker in Indiana history, was honored on the House floor, as are all retiring members, but his had a little bit of extra history attached to it.
Brandon Smith reports on the session during the session, but he's our guy at the State House all year. Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you.
And you can catch him this evening on Indiana Week in Review, 6 p.m. Eastern, on our flagship station WFYI, as well as WBAA West Lafayette. Up next, education reporter Jeannie Lindsay clears up the new legislation that would mean standardized test scores would not factor into Indiana teacher evaluations. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're a week away from the end of the 2020 legislative session. Some bills are getting left behind, just the nature of the session, but one made it through this week that would allow schools to decide just how much test scores factor into teacher evaluations. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay joins us now from Bloomington to help us understand it. Hi, Jeannie.
Hello.
So let's get the short version to start with. Test scores are factored into teacher evaluations. Are we talking standardized tests like ILEARN, or are we talking any test like geography or an algebra test or something like that?
Right. So we are only talking about standardized tests here. Schools can come up with their own teacher evaluation plans, so they can determine, you know, what factors into that outside of what's prescribed in state law. But yeah, we're just talking about ILEARN standardized testing for this purpose today.
I mean, it seems fair enough. A teacher's job is to teach, and if they're an effective teacher, the students should test well. But it sounds to me like it might not be that simple.
Right. It's actually kind of a complicated debate, and people have various opinions on all sides of it. There was a big push with that idea to hold teachers accountable, really revamp teacher evaluations, because a lot of people agree with that idea. You know, if teachers are teaching the standards that kids are being tested on, you know, logically, they reasoned that students should be able to perform on those tests. But, you know, teachers and some of the data and research that has come out since this has been happening doesn't paint as clear of a picture. It's really complicated. There are a lot of factors with how students learn, where they're at, how tests even work. So it is really complicated, and it's not just that point A to point B a simple measure.
So I want to break down the two factors here a little bit more, testing and teacher evaluations. First of all, what are we talking about when we use the term teacher evaluations?
So it's how a teacher does their job. I've talked to some teachers and obviously some school officials, and it really comes down to how effective teachers are working with students and also educating them so that they are learning things that, you know, they could learn for tests, but also to just live in the world as a person and, you know, continue learning as they live their lives. So it's really complicated, and that's one of the reasons why the, you know, teachers and testing debate is so complicated, because teachers do so much more than just what students are being evaluated on for tests, assessed on. So when we talk about teacher evaluations, it's really how they are working in their classrooms, working with kids, and also teaching that content.
So then what makes a good teacher evaluation?
Right. And teachers have a lot to say about this. You know, they really want an evaluation that's done by a trained evaluator. There's use for data in schools. Obviously, there's a ton. But when it comes to really, truly understanding how well teachers are doing their jobs, a lot of them say it's a combination of knowing the content and the standards for the year that you're teaching, the grade level that you're teaching at, but also how what you're teaching now can affect a student down the road, right? How what you learn in fourth grade can help a student, you know, in sixth or seventh grade. So it's kind of, you know, the now content and the later content, and then also how well they meet their students' needs. Because, you know, as we know, students are people and people are complicated. So when students have different things at home and they have different backgrounds and things like that, you know, a teacher evaluation is a trained human evaluator to really see how these teachers are working with their students in a classroom setting where so much is talked about and done with all kinds of different kids. So that's what I think I've heard the most from teachers, is they want an evaluation with a trained person that's less reliant maybe on those data points, because there are so many complicating factors to how teachers work with students.
All right, let's go to the other variable here. What about testing? How long have test scores, standardized test scores, been tied to teacher evaluations?
This was kind of a fun part for me to report this story because I got to dive into history. And there's been a lot of accumulation of data over time. And so basically in 2011, there was a kind of a national push to really revamp teacher evaluations. There was a lot of concern that teacher evaluations weren't being done in some cases and not being done well or regularly. So in 2011, Indiana was one of the states that kind of hopped on this national movement bandwagon to really drill down into this and focus on it. So in the 2011 legislative session, lawmakers approved legislation to tie teacher evaluations to student test scores. And that started happening in earnest in 2013 because, you know, you can pass laws, but there needs to be time to implement that. So it's been just a little less than a decade now, but plenty of time for us to see kind of how it's played out. And so it wasn't just Indiana deciding to do this. It really was a national movement. The Obama administration was really adamant about this. It was called Race to the Top initiatives. There were grants that were available. So states were trying to, you know, posit themselves to be qualified for those grants and get some of that funding. And part of that was to make these changes.
Right. But anyone who pays close attention to Indiana education news, especially in the last couple of years, knows that testing has changed a lot since 2011 or 2013 when it went into effect. Correct?
Yeah. Testing has changed quite a bit. And one of those things that happened, I mean, I've got a timeline written down. It's actually in the story because so many changes have happened. In 2011, there was the legislation that was passed to tie teacher evaluations to test scores. But the year before, lawmakers passed legislation to create a new test called the iRead 3. It's the third grade reading test. And so that was also the same year that Indiana adopted Common Core. And it was also the first year that high schoolers took end of course exams. But then a few years later in 2014, Indiana left Common Core. And so Indiana had to change its standardized testing to fit in with federal guidelines that following year, and that's when they created iStep Plus. And then after iStep Plus came out, a couple years after that, lawmakers voted to replace iStep Plus with the new iLearn that we've been talking a lot about. And then they also approved changes to high school exams. Graduation pathways were also approved in 2017. And so the high school end of course assessments are changing again. And those will be changed to either the SAT or ACT starting in 2022. So it's been a tumultuous decade for testing in Indiana for a number of political and, you know, just state laws and federal reasons. So it's been a really complicated journey. But Indiana has been trying to do, you know, what Indiana wants to do for Hoosiers. And so that's kind of what we've seen play out. And it's been driven by a lot of different forces. But, you know, all of this trickles down to a really complicated time for schools and teachers and students and families.
Well, in the new iLearn test, the one that's being implemented now, it didn't go so well for Indiana students when it first came out. How many students passed?
So this was a different test. There was a huge change. And anytime you see a shift to a new test, you know, people say that it makes sense to have, you know, a change in scores. And as students get used to a new format, iLearn is computer adaptive. So that was a big change. But yeah, only about 37% of students who took the iLearn passed both the English language arts and the math portion. So that's just over a third of kids in the state. And that was really concerning. You know, on the iStep, we saw upwards of, I think, around 60%. I don't have that number in front of me, but, you know, it was a bit higher. And so when we saw that big drop with the new iLearn, quite frankly, freaked a lot of people out. And so there were a lot of questions about the test, whether it was valid, you know, what happened, basically. But, you know, the Department of Education has said that, like I was pointing out, you know, it's a computer adaptive test now. It's new. The standards are a little bit different. One of the things that we can kind of compare, there's a national test that's commonly referred to as the Nation's Report Card. And the performance numbers for Hoosiers on the iLearn look really similar to that national report card test. And so, you know, state officials are saying that, you know, the iLearn is more rigorous. You know, it kind of aligns with those national standards that, you know, kids have been taking on the nation's report card test. But yeah, the 37% passage rate for both the math and the ELA really had a lot of people concerned.
And so the state voted to hold teachers and schools harmless for the 2019 iLearn scores, one of just a few things the Red for Ed movement was asking for and actually got. Can you explain what that means? What does hold harmless mean and how long that's supposed to last?
So the hold harmless is the language of the state. That's kind of how they've all referred to it. And if you really, I guess, focus on what hold harmless, you know, those words themselves even mean, it's basically just that. It's not penalizing schools or teachers for that significant drop from the iStep to the iLearn. The way that the accountability system is set up in Indiana, you know, if those scores were used on the A through F system right now, you know, there some schools, if they didn't see good enough, you know, scores, they could have been targeted for, you know, state intervention, turnaround efforts, things like that. And then, of course, the teacher evaluations component of it. So it's really just a way to avoid any of those consequences that are usually triggered by, you know, low test score data. And so lawmakers have passed that, and it will be a 2-year hold harmless. So the governor's already signed this bill. You know, state letter grades came out this week from the state board. And so basically what it does is that schools and districts will not see a lower letter grade than what they received in 2018. So 2019 letter grades just came out. 2020 letter grades are going to come out, and those will be also held harmless. And then in 2021, we'll return back into the regular accountability system unless there are, you know, additional legislative changes. But, you know, this year, the hold harmless is going to last for 2 years.
So I understand why new tests need kind of this grace period, but what can we learn from these new tests? Again, 37% passage rate, but can we learn something from these new tests or testing in general?
Well, and that's a great question, because anytime you have, you know, data, I feel like you can learn something, right? And so when you see these new tests, especially with, you know, how the nation's report card test goes, you can kind of compare how students are doing, you know, compared to one another, you know, despite the, you know, statewide drop, you know, kids across the state of Indiana all took iLearn. So you can still compare and kind of see how students are doing compared to other students. And that's one of the things that teachers say. You know, you can use testing to, you know, guide instruction and to, you know, get kind of a measure of how kids are doing. And so, but maybe not necessarily use that to, you know, hold people to different consequences and things like that with the teacher evaluation stuff. One of the other things that I think is really important to remember with test scores is that, you know, with the data that we get from it, you know, you can see which kind of student groups are doing, you know, how they're doing on these tests. So one of the things that I've been really interested in and trying to focus more on is the idea of, you know, equity for students, opportunity gaps. I mean, you can look at test score data and kind of see different student groups and how they compare. I mean, white kids, high-income kids perform better on test scores than low-income kids, black kids, special education students, and English language learners. So that can help schools kind of target where supports might need to be done. It might, you know, signal that something needs to change for different student groups. So it can really be helpful to target some of that extra help and assistance.
All right, back to the new legislation. What does this bill do?
So this bill doesn't completely change teacher evaluations for districts, because schools will ultimately decide how they want to use test scores and teacher evaluations. But it is significant because it's basically the state backing off of this requirement. So the language in the bill specifically removes the thing that was added in 2011 that says teacher evaluations have to be significantly informed by student test scores. And so with that removal, you know, the state is not requiring that anymore, and schools will still have to submit evaluation plans to the state. So it's basically freeing local schools to come up with how they want to do that. And so teachers are really excited about it because, you know, they are very adamant about, you know, locals doing what is best for their communities. And so teachers will get to work with, you know, their administrators and their districts locally to make that decision instead of the state coming in and saying what it has to look like.
What are some of the reasons teachers don't want testing counted in teacher evaluations?
So teachers feel like it's not effective. One of the things I talked to the president of the Indiana State Teachers Association, Keith Gamble, and he was talking about the timing of test score data with teacher evaluations. And here's what he had to say.
If you recognize after the test results have come out, maybe we needed a different course of action. then you've spent 100 days of that student's time when you could have been making adjustments earlier.
So basically what he's saying there is that the testing data, if it comes out after the fact, teachers can't necessarily adjust. So teachers feel like, you know, if they are being evaluated on something and they get that information on the front side, they can change their instruction to really benefit students. One of the other things that Keith Gamble was telling me was that teachers who are on the cusp of the categories, testing can really make or break their evaluations in some cases. So if you are performing really well on an evaluation and you are in the top category, but you're just kind of on the edge of it, and test scores are then factored in and it drops you down one, that can affect your pay, and it can affect, you know, your overall rating as a teacher. And so that adds a lot of stress for educators, and they just really don't like that.
And as we said, it is moving through the session with just days left. What is the current status of this bill?
So the whirlwind of the legislative session this week has been a lot to keep track of, but this bill actually passed the second chamber. So it's passed through the House and it's passed through the Senate. And so it is it should be on its way to the governor's desk if there weren't any changes, which I believe it was not changed at all. I think they passed it through unanimously with no amendments. So it's on its way to becoming law.
Jeannie Lindsay reports on education for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jeannie, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.
Up next, presidential memoirs with Indiana connections. We'll talk about the new book, Author in Chief. Next, I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Have you ever read a presidential memoir? Or maybe you thought about it but had trouble choosing which one? Well, maybe start here. Indiana native Craig Fairman has steeped himself in the many books written by U.S. presidents for about a decade now and has written a comprehensive guide to these works full of fun facts and behind-the-scenes stories. Author in Chief, The Untold Story of Our Presidents and the Books They Wrote is out now, and Craig Fairman joins us now from Bloomington. Hi, Craig.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So what got you interested in going down this path? There's a lot of pages on this subject.
Yeah, well, it was a long journey, and it started way back in 2008. I was really paying close attention to the election that year. It was a really exciting presidential election. And one thing that made it exciting was that books were right at the heart of it. Barack Obama had a best-selling book. John McCain had a best-selling book. And so it was just really cool to see those books resonating with readers and resonating with voters. And it made me curious. I wondered, is there a history here? Is this something that's happened before? And so the next year, I really started digging in. And what surprised me is that this has happened so many times. These books have been at the center of American history. The first campaign book, and I kind of talk about two kinds of books in my book, the first campaign book came from Thomas Jefferson, and the first presidential memoir came from John Adams. So the history of these books is as old as American history itself.
And so, yeah, nowadays a president can write a book before they're elected, in the case of John McCain and Barack Obama, and then after they leave office. A recent example, I guess, and it's not even out yet, being Barack Obama's and he, of course, had the audacity of Hope out 2 years before he was elected. And then he's currently working on his presidential memoir, running late based on everything I've seen. But what's the difference between those two kinds of books, the campaign book and then the post-memoir?
Yeah, well, I think they both serve a distinct purpose. And the similarity between them, at least, is that they're both really popular and that American readers have always responded to them because Americans love learning about presidents and love reading for practical reasons. So with the campaign book, the practical reason to read is just, who is this person? What do they stand for? What are their ideas? And in a few cases, when these books have really kind of changed careers or turned elections, it's been when somebody's style as a writer lines up with their backstory as a person, lines up with their political beliefs. And when you have all three of those things working in concert, and Obama's book, Dreams for My Father, is a great example of that, it can be a wonderful tool for somebody who wants to win the White House. Then after you leave the White House, you can kind of write a book that says, this is what happened. This is how I saw things. This is why I was right. And believe me, every president thinks they were right. But those books can be interesting in their own ways. And especially when you go behind the scenes and see what they were writing and what they were struggling with, I think it shows a very human side of our presidents.
Now, at that time, again, we're talking about the 2008 election primarily. At that time, you know, John McCain has a book out, Barack Obama has a book out. Did you read both of those before the election, or have you just read them since then?
I read them during the election, and that's when I sort of got that idea. And I was also talking to my friends who'd read them, and we were all it's just exciting to see a book at the middle of the civic conversation and to see people responding to it. So it's not just that these are good books, and they definitely are good books. It's that they're books that are widely read and can sort of serve as a location for all Americans to have discussions and share ideas. And we're talking about 2008, too. So it's, you know, nowadays there's TV. Nowadays there's Twitter. Of course, those are important media for running for president. But books still really matter. They've mattered at the beginning, and they still matter today. A good book can make a big difference for a politician.
There's a lot in here in the book, again, which is called Author in Chief, and it's out now. And there's a lot in here that I would have to assume is not on the pages of the books that you're referring to. You really dug in. You found background stuff, really fun stories about the process. How did you find all this?
Well, I kind of worked in three different modes. I would go to archives, and I visited more than a dozen archives. One of the most important ones was actually right here in Bloomington, Indiana, at the Lilly Library. But I went all over the country, and I found letters in Andrew Jackson's handwriting that no one had ever seen before, letters in Ronald Reagan's handwriting that no one had ever seen. And wow. So I really found a lot of new material in that way. And then I would also use these kind of digital databases, which allow you to search old newspapers. And that's so helpful because these books were the popular culture of their time. So they were being written about constantly. You just have to find the newspaper clippings. And that's of course, the trick. But when you can search them, as you can now with these newer technologies, you can find amazing stories that were written about these books in real time. And then I did a lot of interviews. And it was fun to do the interviews because I would ask questions that people just hadn't been asked before, because nobody had ever written about presidents in their books. It's still kind of surprising to me that nobody had dug into this. But I would, you know, I interviewed Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, who's in his late 80s or early 90s at this point, and has been interviewed hundreds of times. And when I asked him, you know, tell me about these book signings Reagan did in 1965, he just started laughing. He said, believe it or not, no one's ever asked me that. And I got these amazing stories that tell you something about Reagan's political beliefs, but also tell you something about him as a person.
There is a surprising amount of Indiana-related material in this book. We can't hit all of it in the small amount of time that we have here, but maybe we can touch on the high points. Let's talk about Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, spent part of his childhood in Indiana. How did Lincoln view books growing up?
Well, it's a great question. And I think that, you know, if people know Lincoln, they know the log cabin that he grew up in, and they know that he loved books. And that stuff is definitely true. But what maybe people don't appreciate, and I'm always trying to sort of bring in literary context in my book, I like to tell people that, you know, if you like reading good books and reading history, my book will tell you the history of yourself. And so with the Lincoln material, it's not just that Lincoln loved books, it's that he was very rare in loving and seeking out books. There's a statistic that's still pretty mind-blowing. During Lincoln's time in Indiana, in the southern part of the state, which was still basically the frontier, it wasn't the Middle West, it was the West. During that time period, only 1 in 5 households had a book, like owned one book, because books were expensive and books were heavy. And if you're moving in a wagon across the country, you've got to be really careful about what you're keeping and what you're not keeping. So books were rare in this part of the state. Indianapolis didn't even get its first bookstore until 1833. And so the fact that books were hard to get to, if you really loved books, that was a personal choice. And so Lincoln would borrow books from people. He would, you know, make deals where, hey, I'll work in your fields for a little bit in exchange for borrowing a book. And he did that because books mattered to him. And I think books really opened up the world to him. That's when he first started thinking about big ideas like politics and liberty and what American history should mean. Books were where he did that.
And as we know, he was an elegant communicator on and off the page. How did his love of reading inform his writing?
Well, this was probably the biggest surprise for me in 10 years of research, was that Lincoln wrote a book. And it's, you know, people know his famous speeches. But the thing that really helped him when he was running for president was one of those campaign books. He put together a book that had the transcripts of his debates with Stephen Douglas that had happened a couple years before in 1858. And this was not an easy thing to do because, you know, there weren't as many newspapers. There obviously wasn't Google or any of those kinds of resources. So Lincoln did the legwork behind the scenes to get the best copies. He edited them very carefully, put them together, went through a couple printers trying to find the right one, because Lincoln was a pretty demanding author. You know, he was a book lover, so he knew exactly what he wanted his book to be. And he finally puts this book together, and it's astonishing to me that it hasn't been a key part of every Lincoln biography, because it so clearly shows who he is and what he believes. But this book became a huge bestseller in 1860 when he was running for president. People would come up to Lincoln and say, well, what do you think about this? Or what do you believe about this? And he would say, why don't you just go look at my book? And a lot of Americans did. It sold about 50,000 copies, which is a big number. But if you adjust it by the population of America to the population of America today, it's the equivalent of 500,000 copies. So this book by Lincoln contained his most eloquent statements and his best ideas. And it was right at the center of that crucial election of 1860.
So it was a very different time, though, when it came to things written by presidents then, right?
Yeah, it was. I talked about Lincoln working in secret, and the secrecy was really important, because if you wanted to run for president in that time period, you wouldn't go out and say, hey, this is what I believe in. This is why you should vote for me, because most voters would see that as a negative. They would see that as proof that you were too brash and too conceited and didn't really deserve to be president in the first place. Obviously, it's completely opposite now, where everybody is going to go out and campaign and try to be on TV and really present their ideas in books and in other media. So for Lincoln, the key thing was to be really careful and really quiet, because he knew a book could make a difference, but he also knew that he couldn't receive credit for that book. And so that's where I really had to sleuth and look behind the scenes to find those answers. But I also think that he had that idea for why a book could make a difference because he grew up in Indiana. You know, books were rare and precious and important to him growing up in southern Indiana. And that mindset showed up again when he ran for president, because he realized that books had changed his life, so books could change the entire course of American history.
And so did Lincoln's time then mark a shift? Did it then become more acceptable for presidents to write about themselves after that?
That's absolutely true. It was a slow shift. Most shifts in history are. But, you know, within a couple decades, more and more presidents started doing this kind of thing. I still remember finding some documents at the Lilly Library here in Indiana about William McKinley, where McKinley was working behind the scenes to have a collection of his speeches come out. This was in the 1890s. And McKinley was, you know, so involved that he was saying, this is how much it should cost. This is how it should be printed. And what really cracked me up is the book came out a couple of years before McKinley ran for president. And yet the reviews all said, well, McKinley's got a book. I guess that means he's running for president, which is, of course, the joke we would make today about somebody with a new book deal. But even in the 1890s, they were doing it because these books have always been so important to American history.
Well, let's jump a couple of decades ahead, or maybe a few more. President Grant has a well-known memoir with an Indiana connection. What's that story?
Yeah, the book is well known. The Indiana connection is not. And I, you know, as a Hoosier myself, I was so thrilled to give a little credit and bring a little attention to an overlooked Hoosier literary figure. And I tried to do that a few times in the book. So Grant's book is an example of sort of that other category, the presidential memoir, or the legacy book. He doesn't really write that much about the presidency in his book. He writes mostly about his time in the Civil War. And Grant, for the longest time, didn't want to write a book. There was a lot of pressure for him to do it because he was the most famous general and a famous president, too. But he didn't see himself as a writer. He was very self-conscious about it, even though he was a big reader and a wonderful communicator. And so he just didn't really think that he had it in them. And finally, he had personal tragedy strike. First, he went bankrupt. Then he developed a fatal form of cancer. And so he had these two pressures, which meant he knew he had limited time to get his views on history down and also to provide for his family. So he started writing, and he started out writing these magazine stories first, which he was paid fabulous sums for because, you know, he was a huge celebrity and everyone wanted to read this. And he wrote the first version for an editor named Robert Johnson, who was from Indiana. And the first version was kind of terrible. I studied Grant's handwritten drafts and kind of compared them, and it was very dry. It was very ponderous. There were more statistics than there were flickers of humanity. And so Johnson was a good editor, and he knew this. And so he went to meet with Grant, and Johnson knew in the back of his head that Grant was very self-conscious about his writing. So he didn't want to come out and just, you know, say, this isn't good enough. Instead, they just started talking person to person. And Johnson just asked these kinds of little leading questions like, well, what did you think about then? Or what did you feel like at this point in the story? And Grant off the page, you know, not being too self-conscious, was wonderful. He would tell these amazing stories about trying to spend the night in a makeshift hospital But, you know, hearing the screams of his own soldiers having their limbs amputated was so harrowing that Grant just went and stood outside in the rain because he couldn't bear, you know, to see that kind of suffering up close. And so the stories were amazing. And as Grant was telling them, Johnson had a newspaper in his lap and he just kind of scribbled little notes. And then when they were done, Johnson showed him the notes and said, "This is the book. This is the story. You've got it all inside you. You just have to tell the personal parts." And it clicked for Grant immediately. And Grant started loving writing. He started working really hard, not just on articles, but on this book-length project. And Johnson, you know, the Hoosier editor, he was really the one who helped Grant see what kind of writer he needed to be. And the result was a book that's not just a classic of presidential writing, but a classic of American literature.
All right, let's jump into the 20th century for another Indiana story. And this one doesn't reflect so well on our state, but it's kind of funny. This is about Harry Truman. First of all, how was the process of a presidential memoir different at this time than, say, from the time of Grant or Lincoln?
Sure. Yeah. So when Grant was working on his book, it was kind of him. He did the writing. Sometimes he would dictate to somebody, and then he had, you know, family members fact checking. And the reason it was a more streamlined process was that the presidency or being a general was more streamlined, too, in the 19th century. But by the 20th century, everything is more complicated. Everything has more layers. You know, presidents are now not just worrying about silver currency questions. They're worrying about atomic bombs in the Soviet Union. And so it makes sense that there's just a lot more paperwork produced and a lot more material to cover. And so Truman kind of created a new administration to work on his book. There were more than a dozen people who helped him. And he had ghostwriters, and I do want to say that I've got nothing against ghostwriting. George Washington used ghostwriters. He was smart enough that his ghostwriters were people like Alexander Hamilton. So what it comes down to is picking the right ghostwriter and working hard. Truman worked really hard. You've got to give him credit. He was somebody who loved reading history and felt that he owed an obligation to history. But when it came to the actual ghostwriters, he didn't make the best choices. So his first one was somebody named Robert Harris, another Indiana native who had become a professor. And Harris and Truman kind of worked together, you know, in the mornings at Harry Truman's office in Kansas City. They would talk about a big question like the time that Truman decided to relieve Douglas MacArthur. And then Harris would go off and write it up. But Harris was just not a good writer. He tried to sort of capture those kinds of homespun Midwestern qualities that made Truman a lovable figure, but it just read like a bad parody. It was cheesy. It was so bad that Truman would read the pages and he read and edited every word. He would read them and he wrote on the top of one of them, "Good God, what crap." So Harris wasn't just a bad writer. He was kind of a bad coworker, and everybody in the office hated him. I found these amazing documents where people were just complaining about him behind the scenes. And, you know, he was really causing trouble for everybody. He wrote this 8-page memo that was basically just a minor masterpiece in feeling sorry for yourself about why everybody is looking down on Robert Harris and not giving him enough credit. And about a week after that, Robert Harris got fired and probably deserved it. And so it took Truman a while to find the right ghostwriter, but once he did and had the right team with him, he produced a book that has some really amazing passages and some really wonderful moments. And it was something that just resonated with voters. I looked up an Indianapolis radio station, actually, and they talked about when Harry Truman's memoirs came out, this is the most important book that any American will publish this year. And I think the reason is because, you know, Americans were still getting used to this complicated presidency and this complicated modern world. And here they had one book that could sort of tell them what the one person in charge of it all felt. That was what Truman's memoir did. And that's what the best presidential books can do as well.
And how many ghostwriters did Harry Truman end up going through?
He ended up going through 4. Harris was the worst. There were another 2 who were pretty bad. But the guy that he found at the end was somebody named Francis Heller, who was he and Truman just kind of saw the world the same way. And that's what you need. Ghostwritten books can be really revealing and interesting. Not everybody needs to be a great writer by themselves, but you have to find a writer that you click with, and then you have to work hard. And Truman did work hard. Some of our presidents haven't, and the books haven't been as good as they should have been. But in Truman's case, at least, he finally found the right person, even if that person wasn't from Indiana.
Craig Fairman wrote Author-in-Chief, The Untold Story of Our Presidents and the Books They Wrote. It's out now. Craig, thanks so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're up to. On Monday, we'll talk about Indiana's syringe exchange programs designed to keep IV drug users from spreading infections. Lawmakers this week approved a one-year extension to the programs, which started in 2015 after the HIV outbreak in Scott County. We'll talk to an advocate, a doctor, and a lawmaker about what they've learned in the years since. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.